I'm delighted to be speaking today with Erik Fyrwald, CEO of Syngenta Group. Syngenta is a large international company providing agricultural science and technology. Revenue is $33.4 billion, EBITDA $5.6 billion, and 59,000 employees. Number one in the world in crop protection, patented and off patents, and we'll come back on this. Number three in the world in seeds, and importantly, bought in 2017 by ChemChina for $43 billion, at the time the largest ever by Chinese company. And of course, since then, the company has been taken off the stock market. Erik himself is American. He joined Syngenta as CEO in 2016. Prior to that, he had a very successful career at DuPont, where his last position was Vice President of the Agriculture and Nutrition Division. He was then CEO of Nalco, a leading water treatment products and services company, and of Univar, a leading distributor of chemistry and related services. He serves on the board of pharma giant Eli Lilly and on the UN World Food Programme Farm to Market Alliance. Erik, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jean-François. Great to be here.
Maybe as a start, tell us a bit more about the products and about the innovation process. So, crop protection, what does that include?
Crop protection includes products, chemistries that help plants fight diseases, insects, and weeds. We also have biological products now that enhance the chemistries and enhance the they're like vitamins for the plants, enhance the ability of plants to grow and to combat diseases and insects.
So the first part sounds like pesticides. That's kind of the layman term for this. The second one felt more like fertilizers.
Well, it's more like vitamins.
Okay.
So fertilizers are essential nutrients like food, but the biologicals are more like vitamins that help the plant combat diseases and insects, but also to grow in things like drought conditions or cold conditions and in various conditions.
Okay, now you do crop protection both based on chemistry and biologicals. Please explain the difference to us.
So the chemistry are things that are kind of like medicines. They absolutely take care of the disease, the insects, or the weeds. The biologicals can enhance that ability of the chemistry to take care of those things, those pests, but also are like vitamins because they strengthen the plant. The way we look at it globally is in most markets, you cannot grow a good crop without the chemistry because it enables the plant to realize its yield potential. The biologicals add to that and can reduce the amount of chemistry needed to get the same yields, but also enable the plant to better protect itself against dramatic weather extremes, cold, wind, drought, for example.
Chemistry is quasi-mandatory and biologicals is optional?
Biologicals are more developing now.
Okay.
The chemistry has been used for many years. It's getting better all the time, and therefore we're using far less volume of chemistry. During my time in agriculture, the amount of chemistry used has gone down by 90%. People don't realize that.
Yeah.
But that's been because we're using better chemistry. But now the biologicals is something people have really started to work a lot more on in recent years as we've developed a better understanding of soil health and the plant dynamics of how the plant grows. And how you can enhance that with biologicals, vitamins, and enable the plant to better defend itself. And by doing that, use less chemistry.
Are the innovation cycles similar? Because my understanding is that on the chemistry side, the innovation cycle has become longer and longer and more expensive, in part because of regulatory constraints.
Yeah, the chemistry cycle is about 10 years, very similar for plant health as it is for human health, for pharmaceuticals. And we're actually speeding that up by better knowledge of the chemistry and better knowledge of how it works with the plants, just like in pharmaceuticals. But it's still a long cycle process that requires a lot of regulatory steps. The biologicals are in most jurisdictions much faster to get through the regulatory process. You still need to test them. You still need to ensure the safety for humans, for the soil, for non-target pests, but it's a faster cycle process.
Now, you're number one in the world in crop protection, number three in seeds. Tell us about the seed business.
The seed business is a very important business. We came from farther behind when we were formed as Syngenta 23 years ago, but we've been building this seed business in a number of crops, a number of field crops. So corn, soybeans are the largest field crops in the world, rice, wheat, barley, and other field crops. So that's one unit. And then we have another unit called vegetable seeds, where we do fruits and vegetables. So tomatoes, watermelons, cucumbers, many, many hundreds of vegetables.
And what's the difference between the number three in the world and the number one in the world? The number one has more plants, or they just sell more of the same you do?
They have more market share, particularly in large markets like the United States and a few other markets.
Now, you operate globally. My understanding is your top three markets are US, China, and Brazil.
Correct.
What percentage of your revenues is that, those three markets?
Those three markets together are about $14 billion. So out of $33 billion, almost half of our business.
And the rest also has some big chunks, or is widely distributed?
Well, there's some very other next tier markets, which I would say Canada, Argentina, Australia. Europe as a whole is significant for us, but Europe's about the same size as North America, for example, for us, all of Europe. And then in Africa, South Africa is a big market for us.
I was about to ask you about Africa, because recently I had a discussion with someone who's working in the agricultural industry, and the person said, you don't understand the fact that Africa, of course, needs to feed Africans, but going forward, Africa might be critical for the world's food supply because, he said, two-thirds of the non-yet cultivated arable land lies in Africa. Is that also how you see it, that Africa will become very important, not only to feed Africa, but also to feed the world?
Well, Africa is very important to feed Africa, and today Africa doesn't come close to feeding Africa.
Right.
There's lots of fertile land that has not been developed. There's a lot of farming done in Africa today that's not very productive. So Africa is a high priority for us, both because there's lots of potential and because the population growth there is huge. So Africa is going to have the largest population in the world, and it's the fastest growing population. And today there's massive imports of food and agriculture products to Africa. Africa, the last numbers I saw were over $40 billion of imports, net imports into Africa. And that needs to change because you think about the political stability. More people are employed in agriculture than anything else.
Right.
And if Africa is going to develop, we need to have healthy farmers in Africa so that their kids go to school, so that they have incomes, and that then the kids go either can come back to farming or do other things. But it's fundamental for Africa to succeed to be able to feed itself.
Is there a bit of a vicious circle? I'm a poor farmer. I don't have money to buy products that would help increase my yield. And as a result, I don't have big yields. And as a result, I'm poor. I mean, and I can't buy. So how do you break that cycle? Do governments play a role?
Governments absolutely play a role. And what we are doing, I've been to Africa three times this year. And Africa for us is about a $500 million business. Now it's growing nicely, but $500 million out of $33 billion is not big. It's a little.
So you're going more often than the revenues would justify.
Far more often for two reasons. One is it's important for the future of our company, but I also believe it's important for the future of the world for companies like Syngenta to work with NGOs, and we have a Syngenta Foundation that does a lot of work in Africa. But to work with other companies and country governments to lift up smallholder farmers in Africa. Because if they don't, then African countries can't succeed without a strong agriculture system in that country.
And you need to prime the pump, right?
And because you need to prime the pump by you know, there are many efforts in Africa where people are bringing a piece of the puzzle.
Right.
The issue is, to be successful, you have to bring a solution to farmers. And I'll give you a quick example. So I was in Tanzania 2 weeks ago. And in Tanzania, what we've done is we've partnered with a company called Wilmar. Wilmar is a Singapore-based global agriculture company like Cargill or Bunge or others, or ADM. And they have a large rice mill that they've built in Tanzania, world-scale rice mill. Instead, what they were doing is importing rice to be able to process it in Tanzania, okay, and then exporting the rice.
Doesn't sound very ecologically sound.
Well, it's also not really helping Tanzania much.
Right.
So what they did was they partnered with us, and we partnered with the Tanzanian government and Yara, a fertilizer player, and we put together solutions for rice farmers in Tanzania. We were able to help teach them how to grow rice well and give them the right seeds, the right fertilizer, the right crop protection at the right amounts to be able to more than double their yields and get their quality to what Wilmar needs for their rice mill.
Right.
And so now Wilmar is expanding the rice mill from 100,000 tons a year to 300,000 tons a year because they can source locally. And the joy on the faces of these farmers, we had hundreds of farmers come to an event to talk about this, and they brought their kids, and they were just talking about how their lives were changed because now they're getting a good price and much higher yields for their rice. That kind of model, the collaboration between companies, downstream inputs, and the government, bringing solutions to farmers and then giving them a market for it, that's how we lift up African agriculture.
Very inspiring. Now, please tell us about the competitive landscape. I know you have three major global companies, Bayer, BASF, and Corteva, which I think is the product of the merger between Dow and DuPont. How concentrated is the competition? How much of the market do the four of you represent versus more local and regional players?
The four of us represent the four companies that are doing global research in both crop protection, chemistry and biologicals, and seeds. So there are many other companies in regions. For example, KWS in Germany is a significant seed player. Limagran in France, significant seed players. UPL in India is a global crop protection off-patent player, not heavily into research, more than just applied. So there are many, many competitors, but we are the global R&D focused companies. And that's really important that the world continue to have significant R&D in both seeds and crop protection, both biologicals and chemistry, to enable us to ensure food security and have agriculture part of the solution to climate change. And both are critically important to the world.
And are the four of you like 80% of market share totally globally?
No, more like less than 50%.
Okay. So there's still a fair amount of local and regional competition.
Sure.
Now, 2017 takeover by ChemChina. You were supportive of it at the time. Please tell us what benefits you were hoping to obtain from this very significant transaction.
Well, I'll set the context quickly. So Syngenta at the time was not performing well, had a long history of really good performance and then a period of not so great performance. And then Monsanto from the United States tried a hostile takeover of the company. In fact, at the time, Michel Demarais was our chairman, and he and the board, it was before I got here, he and the board decided that they didn't want to join Monsanto. They believed that Monsanto would have wiped out the company, essentially, would have just taken the technology and moved ahead and wiped out Syngenta, essentially. And at the same time, ChemChina came along and made a bid, all cash bid, at this, roughly the same level as Monsanto was bidding, but promised to keep Syngenta.
Right.
And Michel Demarais negotiated a great deal for ChemChina, for Syngenta, and I think for agriculture, by ensuring that for 5 years, Syngenta would be managed the same way with a global board of directors, with commitments to research and to development, and to investing in the company and staying headquartered in Switzerland. And that 5 years has come up, but everything that was agreed to has continued. So Syngenta has stayed Syngenta.
But that explains how we fought one bid with another, but it doesn't tell us what were the advantages to being acquired by ChemChina.
Well, the one big advantage,
aside from not being acquired by Monsanto.
Yeah. So one big advantage, which is what attracted me, was Syngenta had a long history of really good innovation and technology, a great historical culture, dating back, by the way, 257 years in Switzerland. So I saw this high potential with the company. But one major market, China, had not been penetrated by any of the majors.
Right.
And I had visited China every year since 1990. And I knew that China had lots of potential in agriculture, but I also knew that the agriculture in China was depleting the soils,
right,
was harming the water. There was a lot of water pollution from agriculture, using old chemistries and too much of them, and it just was not where it should be. So I believe that this acquisition could give us the chance to learn how to better play in China and help transform Chinese agriculture, which is exactly what's happened. So when we were acquired in 2017, we were $300 million sales in China. Last year, we were $7.7 billion in China. And the way we've been able to do that is by the same thing we're talking about in Africa, bringing solutions to farmers. Instead of just products, we've created something called the MAP system, the Modern Agriculture Platform System, which are retail outlets, or we call them farmer solution centers, where we help farmers analyze their soil, understand what crop to plant. We get them their seeds, their crop protection, their fertilizer. We help them dramatically improve their yields, improve their soil health, reduce the amount of chemistry they use to protect the environment, and then they get higher quality, so they're getting higher yields, higher prices, and transforming the agriculture in China.
How labor intensive are these additional services that you're describing? Is this mainly tech driven or is this people driven?
It's both. And that's the secret. Because I've seen around the world, in Africa and other parts of the world, digital driven solutions, if they're only digital, they don't work. If they're not digital, if they're only people driven, they don't work because you can't leverage the scale. So there's hundreds of millions of farmers in China. So we have now 700 MAP centers across China, each of them with a set of agronomists, 4 to 6 agronomists, that can teach farmers live. The farmers can come into our centers and learn. They go out to the farms when the farmers are having challenges, but they also use digital tools, imaging tools, to monitor the farms to see where the problems are. Things like application of crop protection products, of fertilizer, of water and of seeds, now going more towards drone applications because there's less labor and it's higher precision.
Now, this sounds like a very different business model than what you guys historically have done, right?
Completely new business model than anybody's doing in the world, really.
How challenging is it for an organization as large as yours, with a business model as well established, to suddenly start pursuing a business model that, again, involves a lot more capabilities, a lot more people, and also capabilities that you guys didn't have before?
Well, it has been a challenge, and it's taken us 7 years now to really get going well with it. And it's still not in total profitable, but each center that's been there for more than 2 years is profitable, but we're adding centers we're taking all the earnings and adding in new centers. It's kind of like the Amazon model when Amazon was building. But we were ideally situated to do this because of the ownership allowed us to get support from the Chinese government that really wanted to see this transformation. our product technology, we understand the seeds, the crop protection. By the way, we're also the largest fertilizer producer and company in China. That capability and our agronomic experts gave us the capability to do it. And then we hired and joined up with some other companies with the technology, the digital component. And so we've got a lot of collaborators, collaboration partners with us there. And
that means an ability to partner.
A huge ability to partner with governments and with finance companies, with digital companies, insurance companies, to put together the solution, and then downstream with the food companies that have the demand. And that whole system, it's taken us 7 years to figure it out, but it keeps getting better. And that concept is what we've been taking to Africa. Now, the model in Africa is going to be different, but it's the same concept. Bring solutions to farmers to enable them to farm better through collaborations, and then connect it to the downstream demand.
I have colleagues who study collaboration capabilities, and they're saying that some companies are just really much better than others at collaborating and at functioning in the, within an ecosystem. Is this something that, that you guys had to develop and learn?
Yes, we're absolutely learning it. And I'll give you an example. 3 weeks ago, I was in China, and I was in China with the CEO of the Nature Conservancy, the largest environmental NGO in the world. She and I went to China. We coordinated our timing in China, and we went to visit a MAP farm that is supplying Nestle with low-carbon wheat,
okay.
Regeneratively grown wheat that has 50% less carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, than other wheat grown in China, across China. So, and obviously we met with some government officials. So you just think about it, 7 years ago, we didn't work with any NGOs. We didn't work with any food companies. We didn't work with governments. And here we are doing that in China. And by the way, the head of the Nature Conservancy Agriculture, a guy by the name of Michael Doan, flew at the same time I did from there to Tanzania, where we're doing the MAP model in Tanzania. So these are collaborations that we never even thought about before that are happening locally and globally. And it's really helping to drive agriculture forward, but also our company.
Over the last few years, Syngenta Group's top line has grown faster than your competitors or your major competitors. Yeah. Bottom line, slightly less fast.
Yeah.
What explains growing faster on the top line and less fast on the bottom line?
So 7 years ago, our MAP business in China was zero. Last year, it was $3.3 billion. Now, the underlying profitability of the stores that have been there for a few years is healthy,
okay.
But we're plowing all that back into the business. So that $3.3 billion is coming with essentially no profitability today, but we're building a model that will produce very good growth and profits for many, many years to come.
So it's a choice. You've chosen to reinvest more aggressively than you might have otherwise.
Yes, and we've also invested more in R&D. We're now spending almost $2 billion a year in research and development, in seeds, crop protection chemistry, also in biologicals, but also in these models, these building these new models.
Now, let's get to the heart of the matter at a global scale. And let me tell you how I understand the situation and your position. Number one, the world needs a growing amount of food to provide enough food for its growing population. Number two, the world also needs the agricultural sector to reduce its carbon footprint if we are to, again, try to contain the temperature rises. Three, farmers all over the world are increasingly facing more challenging conditions, from more weather extremes to water shortages to pests to regulatory constraints. So fair so far?
Yeah.
Now, what I understand from your position, and you're saying, look, in light of number three, which is the farmers have a harder job than before, we cannot satisfy objectives one and two, meaning enough food, reducing the carbon footprint, using conventional agricultural methods, including plowing. Please explain to us why this is so.
Because we need higher yields to feed a growing population. We don't want to increase farmland. We actually would like to reduce farmland to return more land to nature. We want to stop deforestation, of course. So to have higher yields with the weather extremes that are happening more, there's much more drought, there's much higher temperatures, there's much higher wind events and flooding and all kinds, and often multiple events, extremes in one season. So the agriculture needs to be more resilient and have higher yields and reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. So how do we do that? What we talk about, and many others are talking about it too, is go from conventional to regenerative agriculture. Regenerative agriculture meaning regenerate the soils, get the soils healthier, get them more alive, more microorganisms, so the plants can better hold water, the plants can better access water from soils, and do that under extreme weather conditions. It's just some of the practices that have shown deliver the outcomes that we're looking for. Higher yields, healthier soils, lower greenhouse gas emissions are things like no tillage, low or no till. Don't plow the soil. Leave the soil alone so it can better have the microorganisms, the healthy organisms, and don't plow it and let the CO2 or the greenhouse gas emissions come out.
That was a surprise to me. I'm not an agricultural specialist, but I've always assumed that you had to plow the land and you had to turn it over.
You don't have to. And when you do plow it, you get a lot more erosion, as you can imagine. So not plowing it keeps the carbon in the ground.
Okay.
And what you do is you leave the stover, what's left over, the straw from the previous, when you harvest the crop, there's some straw left over. You can see the fields that have been harvested. You leave that so that carbon stays. You don't get rid of that. And that provides more carbon for the soil. And then what we're doing now too is more crop rotations. So instead of, in some farms we're growing corn after corn after corn, you go corn and then beans. The beans put nitrogen back into the soil, the corn takes them out, so that you have a natural rotation that enhances the ability of both plants. And then the other thing that we're promoting is so no-till, crop rotations, and precision agriculture. So imaging to see the land and see where the yields are lower, see where the more fertilizer is needed, or where the pests are, where the crop protection is needed, rather than going everywhere, going where it's needed. And those techniques are really important to really change agriculture. And then the one other one in much of the world is cover crops in the winter. So in the winter in northern climates, you have the soil is just bare. And then you can think of the high winds eroding the soil.
Okay.
And there's no carbon in the soil. So if you plant a cover crop in the winter, you get carbon into the soil and you avoid the soil erosion from the wind. So that's another technique that adds. When you do all those things, you dramatically reduce the greenhouse gases. And as the soil gets richer, you increase the yields and the resilience to weather extremes.
It sounds like an interesting combination of stuff that we've known for a long time, so the best of old techniques, but also enriched by modern capabilities.
Yeah, many of these concepts, like the crop rotations, for example, and even the cover crops, organic farmers have been using it for years. But the no-till requires modern technology to not till, for example. So it's a combination, and new seeds enable the plants also to better protect themselves and to grow under tougher conditions. And so that it's a combination of that.
And that, of course, is where some of your gene editing comes in, right? And this, of course, is making a lot of people nervous. But clearly, you have a strong belief that genetically modified seeds will indeed be a cornerstone of the solution for the world.
So genetically modified seeds today are already in use heavily in the major agriculture countries. So the US, Canada, Brazil, Argentina, Australia, South Africa, Vietnam, many other countries. China is now converting to GMOs. But Europe will not go GMO. But what GMO is GMO is you take a gene from another organism, normally a bacteria in soil, and you put it into the plant. So you take a gene from a bacteria and you insert it into corn or cotton or soybeans. That's GMO. Gene editing, you take the corn or the soybeans or the cotton and you modify a gene within it. You don't take a separate gene.
Okay.
So that seems to be more acceptable to consumers, for example, in Europe, and to many thought leaders that are talking about these issues, because that gene that you modify will modify over time naturally,
right,
through mutations. Now, it may take 2 years, it may take 5 years, it may take 100,000 years, but that gene sometime can mutate to the position that it will be with that gene editing.
So gene editing is, in a way, a more deliberate action than nature provides, but it is along the same lines.
I think the way to describe it is accelerated evolution.
Right, accelerated and guided evolution.
Accelerated and guided evolution that you then have to obviously make sure that the plant is doing the right things and is healthy, so there still should be regulation of gene editing, but I think it's going to have a wider acceptance around the world.
Now, in fact, I read that the regulators are developing a new breeding techniques framework, NBT, which may indeed enable more technology-driven innovation. Is this around this notion of gene editing, or is this something else?
No, gene editing is at the heart of that NBT initiative.
So that's one of the positives, yes, from your point of view, in the position of regulators.
Yes.
Now, European regulators are also pushing for more organic agriculture. Yeah. And I've heard you say, and I've read you as saying, look, I sympathize, but you've got to understand organic is not the solution to producing more food with a lower carbon footprint.
Correct.
Why not?
I believe that strongly because the data demonstrates it. Now, I'm not against people that want to have organic food having organic food, but it costs significantly more, and people are willing to pay 30% more or whatever in grocery stores around where I live. So fine. But organic practices, on average, have about 30 to 35% lower yields. So to have the same amount of food output, you need 30 to 35% more land. And because you're plowing, going over the fields more, in many cases, there's significantly more greenhouse gas emissions. Now, when you look at the food companies, they're all committing to science-based target initiative,
right,
greenhouse gas reductions. Go to their websites, Nestle, Walmart, Pepsi, Unilever, every one of them. What are they driving? Regenerative agriculture. Why? Because they believe it's the right thing, and because they've got to meet their greenhouse gas emission targets, which includes the supply from farms. So they're encouraging, they're supporting farmers to convert to regenerative agriculture because it reduces the greenhouse gas emissions. Look at all those websites. How many do you see with big organic increase goals? I don't see them for the major global food companies.
Now, some of our viewers might think, yeah, of course he would say that because he doesn't have organic products. But you do, actually.
We do.
And because I remember in a previous conversation, you said to me, look, if the world wants organic, I'll sell them organic. I'm just telling you, it's not going to help us meet our goals.
Organic actually has a higher price, significantly higher price at the consumer. And therefore, the farmers can pay for a higher price for the seeds and the pesticides that they use. And they do use pesticides, and we make organic pesticides. And they use a lot of pesticide. But I don't think it's the right thing for the environment of the world. And according to the USDA, who's done a lot of research, they say there's no nutritional benefits to organic versus other foods.
Can you still understand the lack of confidence on the part of lots of people, maybe particularly in Europe, it's true, versus this, or are we simply refusing to accept the benefits of technology and technological progress in an industry which is different from other industries? On the pharma side, we have accepted the fact that there's new technologies and new molecules. On the agricultural side, it seems to be more resistant.
Yeah.
Can you still relate to it, or are you looking at us and saying, come on, get with the program?
No, I think I understand it. I mean, I talk to kids and people that are very much committed to organic, and I listen to them, and they have the right to feel that way and want organic foods. What I do think is really important is understand the data, understand the facts, and I think it's really important for the future of the world, given the existential threat of climate change, that we have a carbon label on foods, that we understand that what the carbon footprint is of foods. Today in China with our MAP centers, we actually in more than 100 products now go all the way to the consumer and have a MAP beside logo and a QR code. The consumer scans the QR code and sees the greenhouse gas emissions and how much pesticide was used versus standard in that area. I think that consumers will pick foods with lower carbon emissions. And I think that's the key to really, that's where we really need to get to, because then it's no longer an ideological discussion. It's a right. Fact-based discussion about how is this food impacting the environment.
Okay.
And so the ability to scan a QR code and see the farmer that grew their tomatoes or their apples or their strawberries and see the sustainability data is exciting to them. And we could do it there because we have blockchain technology there and we're building this value chain with the food companies. In the US and Europe and most of the world, all these steps along the value chain are built. And they're difficult to change it all at once. In China, we were building it, so we could create it.
Now, this modern agriculture platform, MAP, exists in China. You said we're going to adapt it for Africa.
We've started to adapt it for Africa and parts of Southeast Asia.
But Europe and the U.S., impossible because of what you just said.
Well, in Europe and the U.S., there's already very developed channels.
Okay.
So what we're doing in both markets is we're working with the channels to promote regenerative agriculture and the products and the approaches, the agronomic approaches to do that. And by the way, which is great because the food companies want it, which is great, the downstream wants it, so it all fits together. But the value chain is already set up, and now we need to modify the value chain approach to regenerative and scale it up. But everybody believes that and are committing with science-based target initiatives involving Bayer and Corteva and BSF certainly, that we're all committing to greenhouse gas emission reductions, both in our facilities, but also in the value chains that we play in. So what I see is a convergence on this regenerative agriculture. Now there's some different views on what practices and what products should be used, but I think the outcomes we're aligning on, and that's not just with other input companies, that's with the ADMs and the Bungies and the Cargills of the world, but also the food companies around lower greenhouse gas emissions, healthier soils, less water, and higher yields.
So encouraging organic by regulators, not sure. New breeding techniques framework, good thing. What else could and should regulators do to help us transition more quickly to a lower carbon agriculture?
Well, it takes about 3 or 4 years to get a biological up and running in the United States and Canada and Brazil and Argentina. It takes 8 years plus in the EU. Even on chemical pesticides, the EU regulatory process doesn't consider the benefits. So I'll give you an example. We recently in the last few years have developed a fungicide that's more effective, safer, and 20% less volume. And it's being used all over the rest of the world, but not in Europe. It's not approved yet because the European process doesn't look at the benefits, the greenhouse gas emission benefits, the reduced volume benefits. It only looks at, is there any data here that we have any questions about, and just it goes on forever.
So they look more at the danger, not at the benefits.
They have the precautionary principle, which I think it's a good idea. We all want products to be safe and to ensure that they're safe, but you have to also include the benefits,
right?
Because you can't have zero risk with all new technologies and have the benefits. So you've got to have some balance there.
Zero risk limits innovation quite drastically.
Yes. Well, zero risk to where you have to test forever. Right. There has to be a reasonable period at which scientists can agree, a regulatory scientist can agree that that product is safe.
Now, as you know, Eric, I'm a leadership professor, and so I cannot conclude this discussion without asking you a few more personal questions. This is your third CEO position after Nalco and Univar. Of course, different industries and everything, different locations. But what stays the same and what differs across these three jobs?
Well, this company is much bigger than my previous companies and much more complicated given that I'm an American running a Swiss-based company that's owned by the Chinese. And you can imagine with the geopolitics that there's a lot of interesting dynamics every day. Plus, a challenging marketplace that we've been through COVID. We're going through still a war that's horrendous.
So more complexity now and much more stakeholder management.
But much more of both.
Okay.
What I would say gets us through that, me and our team, is purpose-driven. Is this feeling that we play an important role around food security, climate change, and I would say showing that we can work across countries, across geopolitics.
Are there some aspects of the job that kind of remain the same?
Sure. Making
like
sure
what?
That you've got a great team.
Okay.
The people, the leadership capability, that you've got a clear purpose, that you've got clear strategies by business unit, the right focus, and that the company hangs together and it makes sense to be together. And then a good execution process that the different units are executing well and you're getting good feedback about how that's working and able to support the units, which makes it make sense to be together as a company versus just separate companies.
Right. What percentage of your time do you spend managing key stakeholders, internal or external?
A lot more than I would like. A lot more geopolitics than I would like. So I spend every other month or so, I'm a few days in Washington or someplace in the United States, just talking to people, explaining what Syngenta is, explaining how we're run. Because if an American politician just hears from somebody else that Syngenta is a Chinese-owned company, then they immediately think, oh, well, we don't want them to own land here. We don't want them to be part of the U.S. food system. But when we tell them that we've been in the United States supporting farmers for many, many years, it's the same people. No Chinese have come to the United States from this acquisition. We've got the same people, the same team, and we've invested more serving farmers. And I show them the data, I show them the pictures, I take them to our sites. Then it's a different feeling.
Right.
And then also when we talk about, okay, agriculture, why should agriculture be geopolitical? Why shouldn't it be an area of collaboration instead of antagonism? Then it's a better conversation. But that has to take place live. It doesn't work with advertising or articles in newspapers. It has to be person to person with trust that we're Americans that care about American farmers. We're global citizens that care about the world.
Now, you've mentioned traveling to Africa, to China, to the US, everywhere. This sounds like a job that is physically, mentally, and emotionally taxing.
Yeah.
What are some of the routines or rituals or practices that help you to stay at your best amidst all this stress and all this traveling?
Well, one great thing about having my base in Switzerland is go up in the mountains,
okay,
winter or summer, and just be out in nature. You know, it's wonderful to get out in nature and walk, or I like to jog or ride a bike or swim, anything, and just be in nature and get some exercise and clear your head. That to me is really, really important. But also to get away from our business and read other things, read biographies or go and have conversations with people about things other than agriculture, and just open your mind. Like being here today, just having a conversation with you about IMD and what's going on in academics around the world. To me, that's helpful to get out of the day-to-day grind and just stretch your mind and then come back fresh.
Last question. You love your job because?
Because I believe that we have an important purpose. I wake up every morning thankful that I'm part of a team of 59,000 people that collaborate with NGOs, with governments, with other companies to help serve farmers around the world. And I think that's really important.
And how much of your time do you spend about this versus do you spend thinking, and we also have to show a return on investment on this, that, or the other?
Well, I'll show you when we're done here a picture of being in the fields in Tanzania, or whether I was in the fields of China or the fields of the United States, Brazil, all around the world, or here in Switzerland. There's nothing that brings me more joy than being out with farmers, hearing their stories about how they're growing food for the world and doing it increasingly in environmentally friendly ways. And that to me is so motivating and so important.
And profit is the result of a job well done.
And profitable growth over time is a result of a job well done, and that's important, but it's the purpose in serving the farmers, and then the profit is a result. The profit isn't the driving force. It's not the purpose. It's the result of doing the other things well.
Eric, thank you for your time. Thank you for your commitment. And of course, best wishes of luck to you and to your Syngenta Group colleagues. Thank you again.
Thank you, Jean-François.